Hello, I'm Dan Safarik. This is Unfrozen. My guest today is Sarah Bronin. She is an architect, attorney, policymaker, and professor at Cornell University. Born and raised in Houston, the only large U.S. city without zoning, she divides her time between Hartford, Connecticut, and Washington, D.C. Her book is called Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think a lot of people know that zoning is an important vehicle to the way that we design and execute our cities, but there are a lot of subtleties in here that I hadn't realized, and I thought I knew a thing or two about it. What kind of motivated you to set out and set the record straight on what zoning is and isn't?
Well, I think zoning is something that people know exists, and they might think about it as a tool to regulate the amount of housing that we build, but they don't really understand that zoning has all of these other impacts as well. Impacts on our transportation system, on our food supply, on our environment, and even on our quality of life from a day-to-day standpoint. So I wrote Key to the City so that people could understand zoning's multifaceted impacts on the way we live as individuals, as households, and as a society collectively.
And so it is, the origin of zoning is I think perhaps fairly well known in architecture and urbanism circles, which was the idea of separation of uses, or at least the modern version of zoning, I guess you could say. What kind of effect has that had now that we are 25 years into the 21st century? It seems like people have gone kind of sour on separation of uses. It's such a strict interpretation thereof, because that's led to things like sprawl. But if that's the case, then how can zoning be tweaked to better accommodate the kinds of cities that we want to live in the 21st century?
Well, I think you're exactly right. The most common type of residential district in the United States is the single family only district, where only single family housing is allowed. And only allowed, by the way, on large lots, so large parcels of land. Because of that, as you point out, we've seen sprawl happen in inner suburbs, in areas around central cities, and in vast swaths of rural America, where the only thing you can build is again, large lot single family housing. And what that means is that people have to drive. It means that you can't support public transit because there's not enough density to put in even a bus stop in some cases. And it means that people are farther apart. And I think probably the way that we develop our communities has contributed to what many people recognize as an epidemic of loneliness. It's hard to be lonely when you have to walk past your neighbor's house or, you know, run to get a cup of sugar. You can just walk over. It's a lot easier to be lonely when you live really far on a 2-acre lot from any nearby neighbor. So you ask how we might turn that around. And in the book, I talk about the need to retrozone or retrofit communities to make them, at a minimum, to make them allow a mix of uses that's not currently allowed in far too many American zoning districts. And those kinds of uses could be something as innocuous as home offices, which many communities do happen to ban, or it could be things like daycare centers within neighborhoods, small daycare centers. It could be slightly denser housing. It could be allowing garage apartments, what some people call accessory dwelling units. So there's a lot of different ways that we might make our communities slightly more integrated, have a little bit more housing even within existing communities, and also make them more useful to the people who live there.
And so there are clearly, besides the force of inertia and the way that we've done things historically, What do you see as the major obstacles to us getting toward a more exalted kind of zoning? Where the pockets of resistance come from?
Well, listen, I'm not naive. I don't know that every single jurisdiction that meets the criteria or that has the regulatory characteristics that I just talked about, the large lot single family prioritizing approach, that each one of those will change their zoning codes individually. There is certainly lots of resistance to change across any type of regulatory framework. What we have seen, though, really interestingly, across the country is an interest at the state legislature in different states to guide local development through statewide zoning reforms. That, to me, presents maybe the most promise in terms of trying to update these really outdated, decades-old zoning codes to reflect better approaches to land use that we know are possible. But we've also seen, even in which you might consider wealthy suburbs, I include in that bunch Alexandria and Arlington, Virginia, which are suburbs of Washington, D.C., where I live, you have seen the Yes in My Backyard crowd and strong YIMBY movements in those types of communities emerge to say, well, even at the local level, we need to make change. We need to legalize more types of housing. And by gosh, they've done it. They've done it in those places. They've done it in Minneapolis and Seattle, Portland, Oregon, and actually in Hartford, Connecticut, where I worked.
So you grew up in the Houston area, and that is an area that, as noted in the jacket copy, is famous for not having zoning, which isn't to say that there are no rules. It's actually quite the opposite. Restrictive covenants are kind of a concern in that area and the way that they're enforced. I may be wrong about this, but one thing that I had heard was that, in Texas and in Houston specifically, the restrictive covenants are such that if you fall afoul of something that normally would have been enforced by an HOA, the sheriff can enforce it. I don't know if that's actually true, but I've heard some extreme versions of how built space actually does get policed in Houston, if you want to use that word.
So interesting that you say that. Actually, in the book, you might have caught the story about my uncle, who owned a house, what was a house, in one of these exact communities with restrictive covenants. In his case, the house built about 100 years ago had a restrictive covenant that limited ownership of the property to only white people. He's Mexican American like me, and so he probably wouldn't have qualified under that provision, which was made illegal in the 1948 Supreme Court case Shelley versus Kramer, so no longer enforceable anyway. But the other key provision in that restrictive covenant on his property in the unzoned city was that the property had to be used as a residence into infinity. There's no hardship provision or ability to change it. For several decades before he purchased this home on a busy commercial street in Houston, that property had been used for a business. I think it was maybe a photography studio, maybe some sort of service provider, maybe a hair salon. I don't know. Multiple types of business uses had operated on this property. And when he bought it, he wanted to use it for a veterinary clinic. Again, assuming that the provision and the covenant could be ignored. Come to find out, one of the neighbors, I guess, reports him to the city. The city of Houston, you're exactly right, has the authority to enforce the restrictive covenant. So they had issued him a building permit, but then they took it away after the neighbor complained, citing the restrictive covenant. Now, under no circumstances would any normal city, a zoned city, have included this house, which had been operating for decades as a business, which was on a commercial corridor, with lots of other little houses that had been converted to businesses. No other city would have said, no, you got to use that as a residence, or or, you know, we will never give you a building permit. But yet Houston did that on the basis of this restrictive covenant. So you're right that the city does have land use controls, but especially in the case of my uncle, those controls are backwards and much worse than zoning in what they what's on the books and how it's enforced.
And in terms of the way that the physical environment has been affected by this, I think the kind of anecdotal way that people talk about it is to say, well, you could be driving down the street, and you will most likely be driving, and you'll go past, you know, like a horse ranch, and then a skyscraper, and then a mini mall, and then an auto shop, and they're all kind of jumbled together with no kind of logic. You know, and you definitely do kind of feel that effect in certain areas, but I, by and large, I Houston doesn't feel that different to me than any city that does have zoning. I think it seems to me that you know, the market finds a way around these things. It just seems that maybe it's a little bit more unrestricted there. And I guess my question would be, is that your takeaway, having lived in many places, including Houston, and do you feel that it has any special advantages because of the way that it lacks traditional zoning?
Well, lots of people point to Houston as being highly affordable from a housing standpoint. And that is certainly true. It is an easy place to find a home within income limits, according to the statistics. Unfortunately, many of those places are among other things, in locations that are vulnerable to flooding. In a city that was built on a swamp, having land use controls that help to guide development away from flood-prone areas would probably be a useful thing. We also see, and I mentioned this in my sort of personal story that I talk about growing up in the Gulfton neighborhood in Houston, we also see neighborhoods that are highly affordable, but that I think suffer from inappropriate or incompatible land uses. So where I grew up, the apartment building where I grew up in, I visited it again just to make sure that I was talking about it in the right way. And I stood where I would normally stand to go into the complex and turned around. And to my left was a gas station. Right in front of me was a strip mall and the El Principe Azul nightclub. To the right was a self-storage facility. And you think about those uses, that collection of uses, right across a very wide street from where I used to live, and think, wow, is this really where a kid should be growing up? Like, shouldn't across the street there be maybe more housing, more shops, a narrower street at least? But that's not what you see. So I think affordability, you know, comes at a cost in some ways, but there is probably some type of reasonable rules on land development in Houston that could account for that unruly mix of uses in a way that doesn't significantly drive up costs. And I think that's what most cities are trying to do when they try to zone.
One of the sort of, you know, knocks on affordable housing, or one of the discussions about why we have such a difficult time creating useful affordable housing that is actually affordable, is that the construction costs are way out of band compared to what a private development would cost on a similar piece of land at a similar scale. I don't know how much zoning has to do with that, but do you see that zoning has a role to play in making housing more affordable to execute, whether it's being developed by a government agency or by a private company under the auspices of some kind of tax advantage for creating affordable housing?
Absolutely. Zoning can have a huge influence on the cost of housing. A big chunk of housing costs, especially for multifamily housing, is often devoted to the entitlements process. So the process of getting a project permitted. The longer that process takes, the greater the cost on development. That's why I'm a huge fan of making multifamily housing projects, the rules of the game written in advance and the specific applications approved through the planning staff only and not through a public hearing that can slow it down and create uncertainties. The other thing I would say is from a substantive standpoint, in addition to the process standpoint, from a substantive standpoint, we also see zoning provisions that raise the cost of housing, not even necessarily for good reason. We see, for example, parking mandates. So I rail against these in Key to the City, just as many urbanist reformers do. Mandates that property owners provide a certain amount of parking anytime they want to build something are, I think, just flat out irrational. They don't meet any purpose. They make our cities uglier. They make them hotter because of all the asphalt. They constrain development. And especially where a property owner has to build structured parking, it significantly drives up the cost of the housing. And whether people are buying that housing or renting it, it's passed on to the ultimate resident, not just the developers not building the parking and saying, oh, I guess I'll just recoup this cost. That cost is passed on. It makes housing more expensive. So zoning has a ton of provisions like that.
Yeah, I'm thinking about also, the idea of transit-oriented developments and how that starts to cut against the prevalence or the perceived necessity of parking. There's been some successes and some failures along those lines. I think one thing that I've noticed, for example, I lived in Los Angeles for a while, which is a notoriously car-centric city, but does actually have some fairly high densities and some functional transit lines. A lot of the developments that were built around the Red Line subway, in which I think is now known by a letter, that runs from downtown out to North Hollywood, are these huge multifamily developments, but they also have huge parking garages. And I think if you give people the choice, if parking comes with the equation and you don't have to pay extra for it, and it seems to be part of the deal, you're gonna drive. So it's like, I don't know how you create those incentives to actually rely on public transit unless you take the parking away.
Well, I think your point is that if you make parking easy, people will drive. And that has been borne out, that is a statement that has been borne out by research, including research by some former colleagues, Norman Garrick and Chris McCahill, for anybody who's really wants to get into the weeds. If you provide parking, people will drive. Very simple. So, in thinking about how multifamily developers might incentivize residents to not drive, because the developers, they may not want to be building that parking anyway. They would probably rather be building housing. But if the zoning code requires them to do it, then they'll do it. One thing that we do see cities do, the cities that haven't completely eliminated parking mandates, is say, for example, well, we'll reduce your parking burden, developer, if you show us that you have a transportation demand management plan. So if you can show us how you're going to help your residents get around without cars, will reduce your parking requirements. So that is an option in some places, maybe not in the examples that you cite in LA, but it's an example in some places. I think San Francisco and other places have almost completely eliminated, if not totally eliminated, their parking requirements. So LA is a notoriously driving, car-oriented city, but you can see parts of LA that have lots of density, more density even than some places in New York City, which surprisingly has a bunch of density in Manhattan, Long Island City, and Brooklyn, but not so much in Staten Island and even the northern parts of the Bronx. So I think cities are very nuanced, and you can definitely see places even in LA where you can wean residents off of cars.
And then you have a city that's more, lightly populated, but has a long history of a density that it walked away from. You know, if you're thinking about someplace like Hartford, where you had a strong role, can you talk about some of the strategies that you developed to counteract poor zoning decisions that have been made historically?
So in Hartford, like many post-industrial cities, when I became chair of the Planning and Zoning Commission, I inherited a decades-old zoning code, one that had been largely written in the 1950s, when there was a shift in zoning codes, a trend, if you will, nationally, for codes to become much more oriented around the car. And what do I mean by that? I mean that uses like gas stations were included in zoning codes for the first time. Parking mandates were written into zoning codes. And in general, the increase in lot sizes, which would enable people to park a car where they lived on the same lot, was certainly a change that happened in the 1950s and 60s. Hartford was no different. But it was striking to me how a central city that had developed for almost 400 years in a very compact, dense way had adopted, at any point in its history, a zoning code that was so focused on the car. And one of the places that you saw this manifest very prominently in the city was a corridor where I start the book, Albany Avenue. That corridor directly connects Hartford's downtown, which does have small skyscrapers and is the area where the city's insurance industry and hospitals are centered. But it connects downtown to the northwestern suburbs. Hartford itself is a very compact city, as I mentioned, just 18 square miles. And it happens to be a very low income city, a city that is predominantly Black and Latino. And that is in really significant contrast to the suburbs connected to downtown through Albany Avenue. Those suburbs tend to be white, wealthy, high income, again, very different demographically than Hartford. When I first started on the Planning and Zoning Commission, I walked Albany Avenue with a leader that had long tried to care for its, to care for the avenue, the businesses on the avenue, and the residences that lived off of the avenue, Denise Best. And so she was mentioned in my, in the very first part of the book. And that walk really struck me, because when we walked by the Popeyes, the fast food place, and we talked about the smells and the curb cuts, when we looked up and down the avenue and saw gas stations and car washes and building after building that had been demolished to make way for parking, many of the uses there were perfectly legal in the zoning code and in fact encouraged. The parking lots were mandated by the zoning code and by extension the building demolitions. The fast food joints were unregulated in terms of odor, in terms of trash receptacles, in terms of having to have any trees whatsoever. So the whole avenue had been transformed into a wide avenue really meant to get commuters more quickly from one place to the next and to have their needs met along the way, not the needs of the residents who in that particular part of Hartford had high asthma rates, high obesity rates, high rates of diabetes. And I attribute that, and I don't think it's extreme to say that part of the reason for the health conditions and even the socioeconomic conditions of the neighborhood was that zoning code that had stagnated for decades and decades. So I think for me, changing that was a big priority, and through our citywide reforms, we did. We eliminated parking mandates citywide. We created a form-based code that would help to restore Albany Avenue to its maybe former state in some respects, at least with the size and scale of the buildings and their location and relationship to the street. So instead of a strip mall with a parking lot in front, they would be built up to the street to create that walkable street wall that was there historically. By requiring tree plantings, by encouraging complete streets and the integration of transit and more. And so Albany Avenue to me is emblematic of the kinds of changes that we wanted to create, and is also, I think, a real symbol of the failures of zoning and the many, many decades it's going to take, even with a good zoning code, to turn that street and so many others around.
It seemed to me, having actually been down this street, not having seen how it was before, that there had been some demolitions that had been a result of the street being widened, and then it looked like it had been narrowed again as on a kind of road diet. Is that correct?
So Denise and her allies were very successful in getting the state to finally invest in a road diet, you could call it, or a complete streets design for Albany Avenue. And it's amazing to see the change in recent years. What planners call bulb outs to help reduce the distance that pedestrians have to travel to cross Albany Avenue. The street trees, the street furniture that wasn't there before. And just seeing, I mean, even something as small as the trees growing in. They started small. Now, a few years later, they're getting bigger. And it really does change the character of the street. And again, you know, I think in many ways restores it to what it used to be, which is a more of a community hub. It's really starting to get that feel for residents, not just for the commuters that pass through.
So it does seem that you're an advocate for the form-based code, which has its advocates and its detractors. I think the argument for is pretty strong, which is, you know, the idea that the street wall is extremely important in urban locations, and being able to regulate what you can build within that street wall, encouraging actually building up to that street wall as much as possible to maintain the historical integrity of a place that had it in the first place, it seems like a very good use of form-based code. I think where people get sort of, they have objections to it, is when it's in a brand new community and it makes things seem arbitrary, or it makes things seem constrained to a certain set of styles. And I wonder what your feelings were about that. You know, keeping in mind places like a form-based code, you know, put in play in a place like Hartford that's 400 years old might have a different effect than the exact same code, you know, in a place like Seaside, Florida, which is created out of whole cloth. What are your thoughts about how form-based code can be moderated to the environment in which it's being applied?
I think combining a form-based code, which describes the architecture that should result in any particular zoning district or neighborhood, with a as-of-right development process is really the key. Because some might say a form-based code adds cost. Others might say, actually, no, it's great because I know the rules of the game and I know what will be approved. So the guesswork and the cost of guesswork is eliminated. But you know, regardless of what the substantive provisions say, I'll go back to that process comment, which is making those applications approvable as of right, just with the staff review, not with a big public hearing or discretionary processes, is the key. That's the time saver, that's the cost saver, but that's what a form-based code allows, because it provides the certainty of what will be approved with the through the approval process and also through the text of the code that lays out the substantive requirements.
You're mentioning another thing too, which is important, which is this idea of as-of-right development, something that you hear about a lot in the context of extremely dense cities like New York, where that is actually kind of the default in a lot of districts, and so that sometimes comes up in the complaints of people who don't like the high-rise towers that are blocking their light or their views that they previously had. But it can also come up, I think, in these more lower density situations that are in need of, you know, remediation from a car culture. So that's a potentially controversial statement, which is that, you know, the community should be less involved in the planning of its own its own architectural character. Maybe that's putting it too strongly, but, you know, it is true that community meetings and all these processes drag down developments, especially publicly funded developments, for years and years. And as coming from the architecture and engineering side of things, you know, you want to see projects executed and you want to see them go fast. What is the correct role, do you think, between a community and what gets built in that community? What's the right balance there?
I'm a huge fan of public feedback during the drafting of the code process. And I think public feedback is less useful when the issue on the table is a specific application. The reason I think it's less useful is because often what you get is only a select few show up to a potentially hours-long zoning meeting to speak about a specific application. You don't necessarily, for a housing application, have prospective residents coming in to speak in favor of the application. You're much more likely to have existing residents come in to oppose it. And what that means is that public hearings can be very imbalanced. They can maybe only present one view rather than present the range of views of people who might be affected, including positively affected by the construction of a project. So in Hartford, we wrote the zoning code with a lot of public input through the process and made almost every use as of right. That includes, again, all residential, but lots of businesses too. We did reserve public hearing processes for things like new bars and new stadiums and maybe more consequential things with unknown ramifications and impacts on neighbors. But for the most part, we tried to make that process very clear. And again, putting the approvals processes through an as-of-right process was really important.
So to use another sort of hyper-local example, news just broke earlier this week that the Washington Commanders are planning to return to the district itself and out of Landover, Maryland, where they had a stadium for a number of years. I guess they're going to rebuild it on the site of RFK Stadium, which was already kind of a post-war clearance site as opposed to part of an integrated neighborhood. What do you think that process is going to look like? Did they have the rights to just throw it up, or is that the kind of consequential thing where, you know, citizens are going to need to weigh in on the effects it will have? Because it's about much more than just a stadium. They're trying to build a whole neighborhood around it.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that, because I live in Washington, D.C., and last night I was at a community event where the mayor spoke about this exact topic. And what she was most excited about was the fact that the city would pay maybe a quarter of the development costs, mostly in the form of site preparation, she said, and the team would pay the rest. So however the finances work out, and we have certainly seen that stadiums may not always be a benefit to taxpayers, but hopefully this one will. The land use process is going to be really interesting. That site, could be, so the city council and the mayor will have a lot to say over the process behind that site from a zoning standpoint. They could fast track it. They could exempt it from public hearings. I doubt they will, but they could. They could develop a planned development. They could require a master plan for the whole area before any of it gets approved. They could do a number of things, and I'll be interested to see how that works. But you're right. I mean, from a high profile perspective, that's going to be one, like any stadium, but especially one in Washington, D.C., that's going to be have zoning issues, have maybe federal government issues, environmental issues, of course, political issues, financing issues. It's just going to be a good juicy one for people like us who are interested in how that kind of stuff happens.
Well, I think, you know, maybe the to return to the subject once again of the where is the appropriate input point for the general public in terms of what gets built, and you had alluded to the idea that it should happen when the zoning code itself is actually being written. What does that practically look like? Is there a good example of a place where, you know, there is a very transparent and open process for the zoning code process, and then where the result is that as of right developments are easier to do, or there are fewer cases of community meetings where, you know, the question is basically like, do you like this project? Yes, no. And of course, most people who show up are going to say no. Is there a place where that process looks close to the ideal in your estimation?
Well, gosh, I would say, you know, again, that we tried to do that in Hartford, certainly. We tried to get a lot of community input. There are lots of communities that are doing rezonings right now, big and small. Charlottesville, Virginia just did an overhaul. Lots of large cities try to do an overhaul. Boston just announced a couple of years ago that they were going to try to do an overhaul. They scaled it back and scaled it back, and unfortunately, they haven't done much yet. Although I should say, in January 2023, I gave a report to the city of Boston saying that their code was the worst in the country, essentially, to summarize the report. It was so long, so convoluted, essentially a different zoning code for every neighborhood within this fairly small city, 42 square miles. But anyway, so, you know, different cities are endeavoring to or are actually doing rezonings. I don't think there's any one model. One thing I do see as a concern is that cities tend to outsource these big zoning efforts to consultants. I was just up in Pittsburgh doing a talk about Key to the City, and there was a city council member there and a few other well-placed Pittsburghers, and I found out that the city is spending, I think, $5 million on the planning consultants to help them gear up for a rezoning, not even to do the rezoning. And I think that kind of outsourcing, the professionalization of planning and processes like this can go too far. What people are really looking for is leadership from their leaders, the people they elected, the people that they trust. They're not looking to necessarily go through some of the planning exercises that you see in cities. We'll put a post-it note if you like this image and, you know, come to this meeting to tell us what you want in your community. It's like people don't have the framework to do that. You have to go to them and meet them where they are. And I think we did that pretty successfully in Hartford. I didn't tell people to come to our meetings. I went to their meetings. You know, we went out into the community like that. And it was, I think, a totally different feel. Hartford had no money. We were, you know, we did have a consultant that did a lot of the legwork in looking at Hartford building types and in developing the graphics for the code. And she was great. But, you know, there was no money for a full blown process like you're seeing in some places. I do sometimes feel like that process can breed mistrust or can make people feel like, oh, I'm just going to another meeting and doing more work for the city. Why can't they just use what I've already told them and come up with something good? So I don't know. I guess those are some off the cuff thoughts on that.
And there's the car again. Just one beep that time, hopefully. So I think to summarize, where do you think we need to go next with zoning and how can we start to shape more equitable cities that are places where we all actually want to be rather than just drive through?
I think zoning is having a real moment right now, and I am really optimistic in seeing the amount of change that's happening both locally and at the state level around the country, change that is bending towards more inclusive communities, that is shedding some of the approaches of the past, change that is bringing in new language in how we talk about zoning and in simplifying zoning codes, which by definition, makes them more accessible, more understandable, and I think more equitable. So I'm very optimistic about what's happening in zoning right now. I think that we are more aware than ever about the consequences of zoning, as well as the technical provisions. I don't think you would have heard people talking about parking mandates 15 years ago, but people are talking about them now, including housing advocates that have worked in housing for decades and decades. So again, I'm really optimistic. I think we have a long ways to go, but I do hope that my book helps to inform those conversations and that people use it so that they too can change zoning for good.
Thank you so much. Sarah Bronin, author of Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. It's been another episode of Unfrozen. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Daniel.